Hey there, far middle constant listeners. I am your host, Nick Deolius, thrilled that you have listened in. Now that it's late February, and it's about the time pitchers and catchers report for spring training, how about a baseball sports dedication for this episode of the Far Middle? Our dedication ties to an interview that I read from a baseball star from the 1950s, a baseball star that old timers and students of the game, they agree, was the strongest player, as in physical strength, of his era. His name was Ted Klaszewski. His nickname was Big Clue, and he played most of his career for the Cincinnati Reds as a first baseman. There was a popular common story from that time about how Dodgers fans, they would be of the opinion that Gil Hodges was the strongest person in baseball. And then when others would challenge that view with, what about Ted Klaszewski? The retort would be, he don't count. He's too strong to be human. Yeah, he would cut off his uniform sleeves at the shoulders because he said his biceps were so large that they made uniform sleeves uncomfortable when swinging the bat, which sort of gave him a personal brand before professional baseball players were encouraged to promote their personal brands. He was not surprisingly a power hitter of his era, and he was also a great hitter overall, often batted over 300. He had seasons where he led the league in hits, seasons where he led in RBIs and also in home runs. And he almost won a triple crown one year. But what elevates Big Clue to far middle dedication status this week, it's not his stats or his strength, but instead his insightful interview from the mid-1950s, where he listed the four most important ingredients that an all-star in baseball must have. They were in order: natural ability, followed by confidence, followed by work ethic, followed by the will to win. And he acknowledged there would be a different mixture or weighting of those four qualities in each all-star, but one way or another, every all-star had to have all four, and typically, natural ability was the most important. He shared in the interview that success, it's not a case of development, but it's more of a case of acquiring confidence through belief. And no one can tell you anything about baseball, or any profession for that matter, that you don't believe yourself. If you believe you can be good at your profession, and you've got the ability, well, then there's nothing that's going to stand in your way, according to Big Clue. Now, I thought that interview was interesting and applicable beyond the baseball diamond. If you're a constant listener who is into motivating teams at your work, or if you are in the human resources field, you might find Big Clue's professional development criteria helpful. Because in the workforce and in the professional world, natural ability can be translated to intelligence, while what he calls confidence, it's still confidence, and what he was identifying as work ethic, yeah, that's still work ethic. And then lastly, that will to win that he speaks about, that equates to what I guess today you would call motivational drive in the workforce. So episode 197, it's dedicated to Ted Klaszewski, or Big Clue, and his views from the mid-1950s on the four ingredients required to succeed in a professional endeavor, four that remain relevant today. We're going to dive deep into a subject this week that I think you're going to find entertaining and thought-provoking. And it's a connection tied back to Big Clue's emphasis on what he called ability in sort of the professional sports world, or what we might call intelligence in the workforce today. Is that being vital to success? We're going to focus on one of the great minds across human history and from a document that he authored that is hundreds of years old, yet perhaps was never more relevant. The great mind, his name at birth, is François-Marie Arouet. Now, it's a Frenchman born in 1694 and whose epic works were published in the mid and late 1700s. You almost assuredly don't recognize that birth name, but you certainly recognize his pen name. His pen name was Voltaire. Yep, the Enlightenment writer, philosopher, the comedian that we would, I guess, consider him today, as well as the great historian. Voltaire loved to employ his wit when criticizing the authority of his day. And back then, that meant he would be criticizing Christianity and the Catholic Church. He went after slavery, and Voltaire was an advocate of a slew of civil liberties, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, an advocate for separation of church and state. Voltaire was at constant risk from his views being strictly censored and the censorship laws at the time of the Catholic French monarchy. And he was a classic liberal before the official moniker of classic liberal even existed. He was basically a founding father of that movement. Voltaire was one of history's great writers, no doubt about that. Versatile and prolific. Versatile as in plays, poems, novels, essays, histories, scientific papers. He did it all. Prolific as in he wrote 20,000 letters and over 2,000 books and pamphlets. Voltaire was one of the first authors, by the way, to become commercially successful internationally. And one of those thousands of books and pamphlets Voltaire authored is where we're going to focus this episode of The Far Middle. One of the shortest and I believe most entertaining and stimulating works that he published. In more modern times, it's been repacked and represented as Voltaire's Alphabet of Wit. And you can pick up a used copy of it for a few bucks, and a new version won't cost much more. It is well worth the investment. The book or pamphlet will fit easily into a pocket. It's arranged in alphabetical order with a short essay on a single word topic under each letter of the alphabet. Now, Voltaire, during this sort of trip through the alphabet, he's insightful, edgy at times, and poignant in these individual topics, thus the fitting name, Alphabet of Wit. Now, more of an extended pamphlet, the lineage of this Alphabet of Wit from Voltaire, it's a bit murky. So here's what I was able to surmise. The articles or essays in the pamphlet first appeared as questions on the Encyclopedia, which is an oft-cited work of Voltaire's. And then these articles that eventually comprise the Alphabet of Wit, they were reprinted as Reason by Alphabet. Then after Voltaire died, these earlier versions, which were concise, like the Alphabet of Wit itself was to be, they were expanded with the addition of his other essays and papers into an 8-volume philosophical dictionary. So sometime after his death, and most editions, by the way, the Alphabet of Wit that I've seen date from the 1940s and 1950s, but at some point a new pocket volume, more representative of Voltaire's earlier shorter works, was published as the Alphabet of Wit. And that is the version that I'm referencing today. Now, we don't have time to go through each letter of Voltaire's alphabet, although I highly recommend that you do. And I will pick out a few and focus on a sentence or two of each of those that bring up common themes of this far middle and that are fascinating to see originally articulated by the genius of Voltaire in the 1700s, yet are so relevant today. This is going to be a lot of fun. Let's get things moving with one of Voltaire's entries under the letter B, which was books. So under the topic of books, he observes that the civilized world is under the sway of books, from the Arab world to China to India to Persia to Europe during his time. And although there are countless mediocre books out there, the few exceptional ones, they've got an outsized and large impact on civilization. Who are the leaders in civilized nations? Well, at least back then, during the time of Voltaire, they were those who were able to read and write. I'm not sure what that answer would be for today. I'll leave that for you to ponder. And this is where you see the wit of Voltaire come out. He points out that although books were once a scarce resource, with the printing press and publishing, books, they're now found, and at his time, they began to be found everywhere. And the trouble during Voltaire's time was that although there were many books, despite the abundance, too few people were reading. Today, it's probably worse with social media, where books in the format that they are presented in, such as ebooks, they've increased exponentially since Voltaire's time, and even fewer humans seem to invest the time to read these days. As I said, a staunch defender of civil liberty, Voltaire recognized how often it's dangerous to write a book, because what you put forth in the book can be viewed as a threat to the establishment, whether it be religion or government or the expert class. That was true in the 1700s during Voltaire's time, and it is true today during our time. So check out this pair of sentences from Voltaire in the 1700s and think about how applicable it is today. This is under the topic of books in his Alphabet of Wit. Quote, if you publish a book, a parish curate accuses you of heresy. A college sophomore denounces you. An illiterate condemns you. The public derides you. Your publisher renounces you. And your wine dealer cuts off your credit. I always add to my prayers, deliver me, O Lord, from the itch of bookmaking. That, constant listeners, is awesome. How about we jump to the entry of dog, which was filed under, of course, the letter D. Voltaire highlights a great irony. On one hand, the domesticated dogs become man's best friend. But on the other hand, when an individual wants to insult another individual, they often resort to calling that person a dog. So when people get angry, they start calling other people dogs, but dogs make people happy. Voltaire's word for the letter E was eloquence. And he observed under eloquence that humans express that trait when they're under the influence of great passion. So an excited person sees things with a special eye. And for truly inspired eloquence, look no further than the topic of liberty, because that requires telling bold truths and applying rational logic supported by data. And when those truths are disliked and the logic is feared, then you see eloquence give way to compliments. That's probably not a desirable thing. Speaking of dogs and eloquence, and yes, I am kidding when I combine those two things, Voltaire had a few words to offer on the topic of government under the letter G. He points out that you would think there is great pleasure in governing because you see so many individuals who are driven to do it and eagerly jump into politics. And there's also more books written on government than there are governors. Despite all the obsession on governing, Voltaire is perplexed why no one has seemed to figure it out yet. Voltaire recounts a story from a traveler to a nation that was in a war with its neighbors. And at the end of the war, the nation found that it paid a heavy price with lost treasure and battle casualties and economic ruin. But a couple of years after the war, the nation rebounded to the point where it was as good, if not better, than that nation was prior to the outbreak of war. So the traveler figured out the reason for this rebound. The host nation and its enemies as well, they were both governed by the inept, but the host nation had a superior private sector and a doer economy, which were the drivers for its quick rebound and resurgence. And that, constant listeners, reminds me of the bureaucratic state and the elite class today with their ineptitude versus the private sector and the achievers that keep America going. No doubt Voltaire was clearly one of history's great philosophers, and his insight comes to bear under the topic of happiness in his Alphabet of Wit. He pondered what makes one person happier than another. Now, for situations where two people are in very different circumstances, so one person's enduring difficult circumstances and the other one's enjoying the best of circumstances, yeah, it's easy to answer that question. But what about the more challenging scenario where Voltaire presents two people that are equally healthy and wealthy and equivalently placed within society? Well, typically, the most moderate and the least worrisome and the most perceptive person ends up being the happier of the two. However, being perceptive, that often coincides with not being moderate. So he concludes that it's not a person's position in life, but instead their disposition that drives the level of happiness of the individual. And a person's disposition, something oftentimes that it's typically outside the direct control of the individual. You can't make it what you'd want it to be. It is, to a large extent, what it is. Now, under the letter M, you will find a short essay encapsulating Voltaire's view on marriage. That view captures the same essence debated today in the United States with domestic policy and whether we should be incentivizing marriage or not. Voltaire, I'll tell you, was of the view that society should induce citizens to marry as early as possible and offer tax incentives for them to do so. And he also suggested the tax incentive to the marrying individual. So the benefit that the person or the people marrying receive, that should be paid for, shouldered by an incremental tax on those of the same age who remain unmarried. Very interesting. And he also posited that married individuals, specifically men, are less likely to commit crimes. Thus, marriage makes society safer. Voltaire saw a virtue benefit to marriage as well, because the father of a family, in his example, I'm sure this applies to a mother as well, but the parents of a family, they're going to think twice before he or she, mom or dad, makes a fool of themselves in a way that would embarrass the family or the kids. Voltaire argued soldiers marrying, that would reduce desertion, because now they're fighting for more than just the state or a flag or as a mercenary. And that's what served as a huge incentive, by the way, for the Romans during their empire. And today, inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., what do you see? There's an endless analysis and lobbying for policies that echo Voltaire's views on the family and on marriage. Very interesting. On the topic of morality, another entry under the letter M, Voltaire points out that it is not something, morality that is, that someone needs to study to understand. There is only one universal morality, similar in the way that there is only one, say, geometry. And the common person, does he need to have a formal education in the classic Greeks to understand right from wrong? No. The individual knows morality from within their heart. And morality has nothing to do with superstition or sort of ceremonies or ideology. Ideologies, they can differ, but morality, that should be constant across individuals who behave rationally. One of the most interesting entries in the alphabet of wit, I believe, is found with the letter N and under the topic of novelty. He points out that human nature tends to be bored by the everyday occurrence, but it gets obsessively interested in the newest shiny thing. He uses the example of how bookshops, they struggle to sell established classics, yet they easily sell and they focus their marketing on recent bestsellers. Men and women in relationships, they often tire of one another. They get distracted and tempted by the novelty, in this case, of another individual. Voltaire ponders that although novelty can lead to poor decisions and upside down priorities, it might be necessary, novelty, to keep humans on top of the food chain in nature. He argues if everybody followed the maxims of being content with what you've got and not to have desire for more than what you have, the society would not be nearly as advanced as it was in his time, and certainly it wouldn't be nearly as advanced as it is today. And with his eternal wit, he comments at the end of the essay, you'll love this, that would also be a tragedy because it would mean that mankind would not have the benefit of Voltaire. Now, I read that essay on novelty, and I think of it sort of serving as a promotion for capitalism over socialism. Now, if I had to pick a favorite entry in Voltaire's Alphabet of Wit, my choice would be under the topic of right, under the letter R. There are some frightening modern parallels to this essay that apply to the Federal Reserve and central banks across the developed world, as well as to the Vatican in Rome. Two topics we discuss from time to time on this podcast, as you constant listeners know. So check out these two quotes out of the essay on right, using a story that Voltaire employs of an individual who dared to speak truth to power. First, the individual ends up going to a government official in charge of finance. This is sort of the central bank, Federal Reserve parallel. And the individual says, and I'm going to quote from Voltaire here, "Sir, you are completely mad. You think that we can increase the national wealth by printing paper money. This is not wealth, but only a sham for the real wealth of produce and manufacture. What you should have increased was our production of grain, wine, and linen, making sure it found a market. But you make 10 times as much in paper notes as we have actual wealth in money and goods. You are 10 times mad." Yes, every sitting governor of the Federal Reserve should read that one. Now, the story goes on. So the individual, he was imprisoned when he spoke truth to power with the government financier. But when he was released, he went on to the Vatican to speak some more truth to power. And he said, quote, "Holy Father, you do everything contrary-wise to the way Christ instructed. He was poor and you are very rich. He paid tribute and you exacted. He submitted to the powers that be and you have become one of them. He wandered on foot and you visit Castle Gandolfo in a splendid carriage. He ate whatever people gave him. You would have us eat fish on Fridays even though we reside far from rivers or the sea." Yeah, now the individual in Voltaire's little story ends up being locked up again and punished each time he spoke truth to power, but he kept going until ultimately he was executed for his message. So Voltaire's final sentence in that essay states, "Nevertheless, he had been right all along." I love it. I think the great author Ayn Rand might have been a fan of Voltaire and might have read his Alphabet of Wit, certainly under the entry of self-love. I don't know that for sure. But when you read the concluding paragraph that Voltaire penned for self-love, it sounds like the founding mother of objectivism speaking herself. Check this out. "Whoever said that self-love is the basis of all our emotions and actions was right. It isn't necessary to prove that men have faces, nor that they possess self-love. It is the instrument of our preservation. It is like a provision for perpetuating mankind. It is essential. It is dear to us. It is delightful. And it should be hidden." Now, that last part of Voltaire making the case for humility while embracing self-love, it's probably the one section that Ayn Rand might have disagreed with. But the rest of it, it's straight out of the teachings of Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. And you know that when two geniuses, Voltaire and Ayn Rand, they agree on something, there's a pretty good chance it's got sound rationale behind it. Interestingly, right after Self-Love comes an essay on slavery in The Alphabet of Wit. And there are parallels and teachings in this entry to be gleaned. Voltaire takes to task those who argue that slavery is superior to free labor because the free laborer has to look after himself or herself and they might go hungry, whereas slaves, they're going to be taken care of by their masters. The problem, of course, beyond the morally bankrupt concept of people owning people, is that the human spirit is going to seek independence, and that if you were wired for freedom, you'll not desire to be in need of someone taking care of you in the form of a master. And when the free individual cannot find work or can't produce, it's typically not because they are independent, but because of impediments that are placed between the worker and their production. Indeed, Voltaire instructs us that it's up to the individual to decide what state of freedom they prefer. And if you ask the humblest worker, who was wearing old clothes and had barely enough to eat and had the most basic roof over their head, whether they would rather be a slave and be given better food, clothes, and shelter, the individual worker would look at you as if you were crazy, which sort of proves Voltaire's point. Now, this entry led me to draw parallels to much of the debate in the United States between North and South just before the Civil War over what was known then as that peculiar institution, with the South putting forth the flawed argument that slavery was a better state for the plantation worker than freedom. And it also got me to thinking about today's administrative state and overly burdensome government regulation, keeping the free individual worker from fulfilling their full productive potential. The last entry that I'm going to mention, at least in this episode of The Far Middle, is the topic of war. Voltaire discerns that war, it's a state of nature, a constant one at that. It's necessary for survival in the animal kingdom. But because God gave man reason, and the expectation was that man would utilize reason to separate and elevate above the animal kingdom, one would surmise war would not be as constant state of affairs when it came to human beings. Yet we continue to war, in many instances, with the combatants not even understanding what the conflict was about to begin with. Worse, much of war is justified in the name of God, which leads to bizarre behaviors that Voltaire was able to identify. So if a general in a battle kills only a couple thousand of enemy, he or she doesn't give thanks to God. But if that general annihilates tens of thousands in combat or destroys a rival nation and levels it in its entirety, that general ends up giving thanks to God. Voltaire concludes that essay on war by providing a bit of a geopolitical dissertation that I think should be read and taken to heart by the leaders of nations today. So he took exception to the argument that sometimes self-defense of a nation dictates war. Basically, that if one country during peaceful times arms itself in a way where it could destroy another nation, then that other nation is justified in immediate attack and war. Voltaire disagrees by pointing out there's nothing stopping the other nation in peacetime from making itself equally powerful to the opposition. The neighbor that you might fear, yeah, may go out and make alliances that threaten you further, but you can make alliances as well. That nation can grow its military, but so can you. And the rival nation might grow its economy into strategic advantage, but you can imitate the same tactic. The point being, there's typically an alternative to war when using it under justification of preventing a rival from gaining irreversible advantage over you, sort of deterrence, for lack of a better term. And that the rational leader is going to avoid war whenever and however possible. And it is a true last resort after an exhaustive failure of everything else, of all other options. And now that we've come toward the end of episode 197 of The Far Middle, I hope you enjoyed that. I think we've got a fitting connection to conclude with, one that ties into the subject of alphabets and language, which Voltaire wrote about and mastered respectively, along with Voltaire's philosophical views on how humanity might get along better. So I think we've got a nice closing connection that ties all those things together. There was a gentleman by the name of L.L. Zamenhof, and he was a Polish doctor who had a side gig. He felt that language was often a barrier and an impediment to people of different cultures growing closer together. So his idea was to develop a single universal language that all peoples and nations could learn and employ, thus removing a key barrier and bringing people together in something that would create a higher likelihood of lasting peace. He created Esperanto as a language. It's mostly based on the Romance languages, and this invention of Esperanto occurred in 1887, and Zamenhof thought that it would become the second language of every nation on earth. That's what he had aspired to. So he didn't view it as supplanting other languages and native tongues, but one of supplementing them. Great concept, but it didn't work. Although sources do cite it as the most successful constructed international auxiliary language, whatever that means. It had powerful enemies that prevented its wide adoption. The Nazis and the communists were not fans of Esperanto. Established religions didn't care for it either. So it never took off to the degree that Zamenhof had hoped. And it is still around today, but it is more of a novelty than anything else. However, if you want to get a feel for what Esperanto looks like or how it reads when translating from English, Google will be happy to oblige you on the web with its translator tool. So until next week, siam restu konakita al tiu malproxima mezo. Or if you prefer that in English, always stay connected to that far middle.